Ah, good evening, everybody. We are finally back. I know we missed a couple of weeks there through some unavailability and Trig's mum managing to hurt her ankle. But we have returned now. We have
Yes.
returned with guest. We have another guest on this week. We have Mr. Prudentialist, who's probably quite a few of you will actually know, because now we have quite a lot of audience overlap. How you doing there, Mr. Prudentialist?
I'm doing quite well. How are you?
I'm pretty good. What time is it for you there anyway? I was curious about that earlier.
It is 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh well, yeah, it's 9 p.m. here, so that is that is a significant 6 hour time difference. I'm joined by my usual co-host Trig, obviously.
Good evening,
Yita.
everyone. Yep.
And
Yep.
Evelyn is also here.
Yes, I am also here.
I'll get the normal stuff out of the way. If you want to donate, the best way to do it is through Streamlabs. It's the pinned comment in chat. It's also in the description that has the smallest cut. We are also, through some miracle, still monetized. So you can join the channel, you can do super chats, but YouTube does take a 30% cut of that, so do be mindful. We do have some other stuff to shill as well very quickly. If you're in the UK, we do have our Nomos Birmingham coming up on the 26th of March. We've already sold, I think, about 26 tickets, and it's pretty early doors still. So do get them. The early bird tickets are already all sold out. I'll put a link in the chat, though I think there's also a link in the description as well. There isn't, but I will put. No, there is. Nomos Events is in the description. But yeah, if you are in the UK and you're available on the 26th of March, we have 90 tickets available. We're going to announce theming and speakers on Saturday. I want to make sure that a lot of the people who'd been before had a chance to buy tickets before we really, really pushed it. But yes, we also, if you want to get it. Sorry, go on.
I would say I would put emphasis on not just for our sake, but for your own sake. If you are interested in going, at least grab your ticket probably in the next week or so, because it'll be like last time when we stayed, took us like a week or two to sell 20 tickets, and then like the other 50 just disappeared in the space of about a week and a half.
Yeah, it does snowball pretty quickly with the Nomos stuff we found, because we only had about 60 tickets last time. We were sold out more than a week in advance. Well, more than a week in advance, actually. So that was pretty good.
And it
I
was a
know
cracking
you've
event last time.
Yes, I got nothing but positive feedback, which either tells me I have a bad sample size or people actually enjoyed it, one or the other. We actually have an article out this week as well. Evelyn has published on the Substack. I've put that in the chat, and the Anti-Politics Substack is also linked in the description, I think. Yes, it is. Find out writing. There it is. But you, if you want to get that up, Evelyn, you have put out an article called Representation, which is
Yeah, I can quickly get that up.
rather good if I don't say so myself. Because you've been reading quite a lot of Ellul.
Yes, I think we or the two of us have really. It's been quite a good read. Yes, I don't know. Go take a look. Thank you to Scrump for making the header image and understanding how graphic design works. But go and read
It's where
and see how you're
graphic design is
being.
my passion.
Yes. See how you're being played. See how they're using moderate arguments to mask their radical nonsense.
But the politics of geopolitics. I'm not actually sure where that title came from, because
Or it just came
you.
up. I just came up with it at the top of my head, to be honest. There is like one. The article, and I managed to find it in like JTOR or something. It's from like 2006 or something. It's literally titled "The Politics of Geopolitics," and like one of the people they talk about is Dugin, but they're talking from like a like strategical kind of thing. Whereas,
Yes.
in the way that we've been looking through a lot of things in relation to, Francis and Burnham, and thinking consciously about how the managerial revolution and the stages before, the stages during, and the stages after really affected different aspects of society. And I don't think people really go to the depths of then thinking about how foreign policy gets developed in that environment. you know, we just have foreign policy think tanks that then sort of think about foreign policy in a vacuum. But as you might understand, as we begin to go through some of the excerpts we've got here, there begins to come that sort of classic, almost anti-liberal realization that, you know, you cannot separate one aspect of the state from the state itself, which I think is...
Yes.
That will become more clear why that's an important statement, but as we go on.
I was going to ask, Prudentialist, do you have anything that you'd like to shill before we start properly? We've got your details in the description here. You obviously have a YouTube channel and you do knock around on Twitter as we all do. But is there anything specific you have coming up that you'd like people to know about?
Yes. So on, what's today? Wednesday now. Thursday, actually. So
yes.
Tomorrow I will have I do what's called Real Talk, R-E-E-L. I do a variety of fishing with some cultural commentary. So that will be out tomorrow, talking about just analog horror from a perspective from the right. And then Sunday, 9 p.m. your time, 3 p.m. mine, we'll be covering the situation in Ukraine with a formal naval officer and commentator, Raging Mandrill, as well as Paul Fahrenheit. So that should be a good time.
Well, he's gonna talk about Yaki and Imperium.
I'm with me.
I mean, but before we get into the excerpts here, and you're studying of sort of geopolitical texts, because I know that's one of your sort of big focuses. Do you recognise the sort of effect that we're sort of trying to hopefully demonstrate over the course of the next couple of hours?
For sure. The way in foreign policy has been conducted changed drastically for America, I would say specifically, probably around the time of Teddy Roosevelt. Your Spanish-American War is really the first instance of empire where things really start to be federalized, governed in such a way where you have bureaus and undersecretaries and planning and papers about planning and papers about what to do next and more interventions. And that kind of skyrockets after the FDR administration, when sort of the Cold War apparatus emerges after the Second World War. But what it's been called, and I think it's John Eikenberry who wrote about it, he called that the post-order, you know, for American foreign policy since 45 has been what's known as liberal hegemony. And that's where sort of you see really the full concepts of managed aspects of war, civilian more oversight. There's a really good article, I think, in the American Affairs Journal that came out a couple of years ago called Data-Driven Defeat, where it just talks about how it's based on algorithms, these plans, these graphs that mean nothing for no coherent objective, which kind of allows war to stay ephemerally present, even if it's not formally declared.
Well, it's essentially the bean counters having their crack at imperialism.
It very much is. I also wanted to comment on something that's kind of unsaid sometimes, but you'll be aware of this trick being our resident boomer. But the complete continuation and the complete through line there has been since the end of the Cold War, that in terms of like international policy and geopolitics, the end of the Cold War actually didn't change the way a lot of the, you know, the liberal democracies behaved at all. Because a lot of their excuse for the way that they conducted geopolitics was the ever-present enemy of the Soviets. And when that, you know, nominally disappeared, they just kept going anyway.
Well, they had to play around with Russia's our friend now. And, you know, you saw a few occasions in sort of popular media. I remember a few Stargate episodes, etc., where the Russians were actually... But even then, they weren't portrayed as the friends. It was always looked at slightly sheepishly, slightly sort of, oh, we don't really trust these Ruskies. And that lasted through a bit of the 90s and then straight back into, you know, generally sort of Putin bad. And let's mock Russia. Ha ha, your economy is terrible, etc., etc. But at the same time, quietly going, still don't like the size of their army. Their army's terrifying. let's mock them a little bit. And then, you know, when was it, 2014, Ukraine happened. Round one of Ukraine happened. And everyone, well, you know, sat there and rattled sabers and did nothing because they were terrified. Because it's still the same. It boils down to it. Russia has a far, far, far bigger land force army and far more capable than NATO can muster.
Especially on the European continent, yeah.
Especially on the European continent. And it's designed in a very different type of warfare as well. America and NATO is designed for air superiority and then take land and mobile warfare, whereas Russia's military is designed for literal sort of artillery bombardment and air defense and take ground slowly and steadily and obliterate everything in front of it. And that the two techniques, the two sort of military technologies, are kind of designed to defend against each other, but you don't want to actually sort of put them against.
No,
if those two forces clash, you're going to see an awful lot of people go, "Oh, all of our stealth planes are all in little bits all of a sudden," and we very rapidly see Vietnam War style sort of bring our soldiers home.
Yeah, it's very, oh dear, the fuselage of our aircraft can be pierced by AK rounds kind of stuff.
Yes, and our carrier groups are being hit by cavitating torpedoes carrying nuclear warheads. We've just lost two carrier groups. This wasn't supposed to happen.
It's funny that geopolitics has so many layers above it that really hot war post 45 has been, you know, in part from in very planned, staged ways. Not to get too far off, I'll round this up. It has been a bit unthinkable, but the way that's moved around, I think, is covered very, very well by these quotes you've picked out, Evelyn. So do you want to get into, before we get too long in the tooth, some of the literature? For those of you who want to read along, I think you've got a Google Doc here, which has it quite nicely, which you can put in the window there. I know this is stuff that most of us have read and covered before. A lot of this has been in the Democratization series previously in different bits. But if you want to read it, the first one, Evelyn, this is from Mises' Human Action, page 815-806. It's such a long fucking book.
Oh, that's great, though.
And from the PDF on the Mises website, which I'll probably actually link in the pinned comment when this is over, it is page 854. I'll actually put that in the chat as well for people who do want to read along. But well, this will, if you're watching the VOD, this will be in the description.
Well, no, I don't know. I want to possibly think back previously to an era where geopolitics wasn't thought of as geopolitics. It was statesmanship. And part of the whole, I think you could even maybe go into a whole linguistic thing about what it required to take this idea of, you know, statesmanship, something clearly vested in an individual leader or a small number of leaders, then becoming geopolitics, which to me becomes a much more sort of collective term in a sense. There is no reverence to some individual who acts in a certain way under some kind of values. It's you know, just some sort of, not utilitarian would be the word, but a pragmatist attempt to put together the warring nations, if you will. No, just a bit from Mises here, where we would like to start. He's talking about the sort of beginning of the starts of conquest and what you could look at as some of the first kind of national wars, quote-unquote, in the sort of medieval era, where he says that this philosophy of boundless conquest also animated the rulers of medieval Europe. They too aimed, first of all, at the utmost expansion of the size of their realms. The institutions of feudalism provided them with only scanty materials for warfare. Vassals were not obliged to fight for their lord more than a limited time. The selfishness of the vassals who insisted on their rights checked the king's aggressiveness. Thus, the peaceful coexistence of a number of sovereign states originated in the 16th century. A Frenchman, Baudin, I guess it's Jean Baudin, developed a theory of national sovereignty. In the 17th century, a Dutchman, Grotius, added to it a theory of international relationships and war and peace. With the disintegration of feudalism, sovereigns could no longer rely upon summoned vassals. They nationalised the country's armed forces. Henceforth, the warriors were the king's mercenaries. The organisation, equipment and support of such troops were rather costly and a heavy burden on the rulers' revenues. The ambitions of the princes were unbounded, but financial considerations forced them to moderate their designs. They no longer planned to conquer a whole country. All they aimed at was the conquest of a few cities or of a province. To attain more would also have been unwise politically, for the European powers were anxious not to let any one of them become too powerful and a menace to their own safety. A too impetuous conqueror must always fear a coalition.
Impetuous.
Yeah, that's the one. Bloody Mises with all these fancy words. Always fear a coalition of all those whom his bigness has frightened. No, it's a very simple point from Mises here that ultimately, in even the medieval ages when there was, you know, a lot of warring and a lot of combat, there was a heavy stricture of the economy upon these of warring actors. And ultimately they had to, you know, whatever their grand plan was, it had to fit within the realms of economic reality.
Yes, it's something that we touch on, me and Utrig, in Democratization, I think the second mm-hmm. episode, when we talk about the pre-World War One stuff. But,
oh, yeah.
It was
very much small armies. I mean, I was reading the Iliad, putting my military hat on, not so long ago, a couple of days ago, actually, and it occurred to me, even back then, thousands of years ago, it took them 10 years to take a city.
Mm-hmm.
A single city. These days, a conquest of an entire continent, even in the 1940s, took, you know, a matter of months. War has changed so dramatically throughout the years, and it used to be, as I said, you know, small province, a city, or something in the space of 6 months.
There was also
longer.
I would say there's also again the point that I was trying to mention earlier with the term statesmanship that Mises so succinctly puts in here in like one sentence: war was not an affair of the peoples, it concerned the rulers only. And that's still the case now, but the, you know, as we will get into with not Mises but some of Hopper's looking at this issue, that's in and of itself is the issue, and that Mises doesn't want to step into the realms past economics where he says the involvement in the state itself is part of the movement towards what we recognise as total war.
He hints at it, and the big thing is when we talk about World War One is credit expansion. It's the role of the Federal Reserve in offering a literal blank check to Europe to destroy itself, and that wasn't possible until that point. And the thesis we try and prove in that episode is that the Federal Reserve and the credit expansion of central banking in Europe is what makes the First World War so deadly. It's not merely the technology, and it's not merely the, you know, the supposed tinderbox of Europe, because Europe had been moving its borders around for the previous 50 years. What happens is that these technologies are very expensive to produce, and it's very expensive to retool your country to produce them. So what Mises is describing here is the situation pre-credit expansion, and really what levels up the world into a situation where it can undertake total war is the economics. And that's kind of the beauty of both Mises and Rothbard when they talk about this stuff, because it's so first principles, but it makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to be said for propaganda as well, the media explosion in the last 100 years. Suddenly it became, look, they're sending Zeppelins over us. The whole country goes mad because cities are in danger now for the first time ever in different countries to where the war's taken place. Well, yeah, again, it's all largely credit. It's all largely the same people. But the use of propaganda is another large part that I haven't touched on enough.
It's interesting to tie Elul and, again, Francis into that kind of understanding, though. You need that mass state and the mass organization so that you have that idea of a total propaganda network. You have the welfare state. You know, you need to have all these elements to screw this kind of war machine that they are essentially building together, whether they know it or not.
Mm. Well, I agree. And, of course, a national broadcasting organization of some sort really helps.
Now, I'm sure you have an interesting take on limited warfare prudential, because you were touching on it a little bit beforehand, because obviously you've read through these quotes, because Evelyn sent them to you earlier. But I know, what is your opinion on the idea of like limited warfare versus modern warfare and the factors that have changed that?
The one thing I would probably push back from the reading that we had was probably that while yes, the ability to raise an army and hold a campaign is vastly limited, there were ways to get the masses to sign up or to engage in siege or conflict as auxiliaries, primarily, especially when we see in sort of interstate conflicts or interregional, I guess, during the Reformation, is that you sort of have the application of what's known as filiatism, which is nationalism applied into ecclesiastical affairs. And when you're telling people at the time, right, of course, a majority Christian continent, various groups and ideas that your soul is on the line, is a very good way to get people involved. And you can see that with external enemies as well, when there was far more papal supremacy during the Crusades. But once there was no longer a call for, say, an ecclesiastical or a religious affair, then yes, it reverts back to small territory. What is in the king's interests? Can I get my vassals to secure a city or... More importantly, right, to secure farmland or something like that.
I mean, it is useful to frame it as the whole public-private distinction to when we look at this, you know, the idea of public and private war, because that's how it's framed in Hoppe, as we'll see later on. But to the point that you're making there, I think the argument is still somewhat valid, because the church at the time was the closest thing, if not almost perfectly suited to being a mass cultural organisation. And it is that mass organization that allowed them to, you know, engage in the rallying of people in the way that you're talking about, in a sort of almost public kind of manner. And I'm suggesting that the way that it works there is the same way that it works here now. It's just that it's more general and it's more prevalent now. There wasn't just like one secondary institution that could all of a sudden decide to wage a war. It's now very much totalized, and there is no other institutions that could possibly actually rally a force like that.
Well, the Reformation and the following wars were an extraordinary event. It's interesting that they are such an outlier when, you know, quote unquote, total war by nation states was the norm in the 20th century. It's just what happened. And like Trigg talked about, the role of propaganda is the other pillar to this. It's the two. It's the mass mobilization, and like the mass mindset has to be with both of them. And we see in the Reformation parts of the mass mindset rear their head, but they do, you know, they do settle down again. It does go back under the surface, because it isn't possible to have what we have today, which is this constant fever pitch.
No. I mean, up until the sort of 19th century, the printing press, big step forward, huge step forward. But huge. The moment you started having things like radio and television, radio, let's call it radio, and the classic, the talkies, the cinema, etc., you could then reach vast quantities of people very, very quickly and tell them whatever narrative you wanted and spin them right up into a fever very, very quickly. Look at these people, they're doing something terrible. They're hurting your fellow man. Let's go get them. And, you know, bingo, suddenly you can mobilize an entire country to war in the space of, you know, a few weeks, essentially. Up until then, it was a case of, you know, the printing press gave you, you know, the newspaper. But that wasn't the same.
And the other...
I wouldn't undersell the impact of the newspaper, especially just even in reference to the most basic aspects of American history, is that even at the beginning of the Republic, the various political factions, I guess what you would consider to be elites of the time, or landed gentry or aristocrats, could easily set up a newspaper and write either, you know, anonymously or whatnot, and they almost got the country into war during the French Revolution. And I just wouldn't undersell it. Yeah, radio is definitely one of the most exponential factors, though, especially if it's state-operated.
Yeah, each one levels up from the other. This is really kind of going into what your article talks about. Because you have the newspaper, which is the written word. You have the radio, which is, you know, the sound in people's homes. Then you have the television, which, you know, is putting pictures in people's homes. Each one is higher impact and has a kind of a more totalizing effect on the way people see themselves in mass media. The other thing I want to say, and I forgot for a second there, was that during especially the medieval period and into the Reformation period, taking the populace off the land was disastrous.
Mm.
It was a very short-term strategy that people could utilize, because if you mobilize too many people, you would, in a matter of months, in some places, starve to death, because you would not have people to bring in the harvests. High medieval period especially, but even into the Reformation, the mass mobilization of people has always been a terrible idea. Because of how much waste it creates and what the disruption it does to, you know, the normal economy of a country. It is a frankly evil thing to do to people. And a lot of the rulers in the medieval period realized that, because they had more permanence, unlike modern elites. They had to live with the consequences of their own wars most of the time. And it was a move of, you know, blind zealotry in some cases, or desperation. But we should probably get on to the second bit of the reading here.
Yeah.
Most
historians entirely fail to recognize the factors which replaced the limited war of the ancient regime by the unlimited war of our age. As they see it, the change came with a shift to the dynastic to the national form of state, and was a consequence of the French Revolution. They look only upon attending phenomena and confuse causes and effects. They speak of the composition of the armies, of strategical and tactical principles, of weapons and transportation facilities, and of many other matters of military art and administrative technicalities. However, all these things do not explain why modern nations prefer aggression to peace, which I think is such an important point that Mises has mentioned here. You know, the economic realities scarcity that affect us all on some level dictate that you must tend towards social cooperation as opposed to disorganization. It's for the same reason you were saying before, you know, you can't force all these people off their lands, because how are they going to provide you food while you're conquering them? So that even within the war itself, there was war with a tendency towards peace, whereas now we have at best a peace with a constant tendency towards war.
In some respects, they've got the same goal, though. There's still an economic force driving it. Back in those days, peace meant, you know, the farming of the land, the creating of wealth. These days, the war itself is the creating of wealth for the higher ups. So there is that economic factor that seems to have flipped around a little bit.
So I'm saying that the incentives are so sort of perverse.
Yeah. Oh, very much so.
Well, it's as the next quote says, what has transformed the limited war between royal armies into total war, the clash between peoples, is not technicality of military art, but the substitution of the welfare state for the laissez-faire state.
Which is Mises's shorthand for the mass state, as you could understand it through Francis. At least that's how I'm thinking about it here.
Yeah. Once the people essentially become public property, that is how you have total war. That's you know, he doesn't say it as explicitly as someone like Hopper does, but that is essentially what he's saying.
Well, this is the distinction that I want to point out here between Mises and Hopper. Hopper, as we will see, he is looking at it more sort of systematically. And he's stepping outside of some of the assumed elements of almost of the liberal framework. And Mises here, because he's talking about economic activity, is trying to talk about the economics of war devoid of a state, which isn't really possible, because as you begin to read more and more theory about how sovereignty works, you cannot have an economy separate from a state, especially not probably post-industrial revolution.
No, I don't know. I'm sure I haven't actually read the entirety of Human Action. I mainly just use you as like the captive autist who can quote it at me. I've read as much as I can, but it's a very big tome. But there's a very, very detailed buildup of stuff in there, and if you can look for it, there's the basis for most of what comes later with people like Hopper and people like Rothbard. And I don't know, I need to read the whole thing at some point, really. This is reminding me. cover to cover.
I've got an audio book to go really lazy.
Oh, gay.
Oh, it's just not the same. See, I just bought a paperback copy and just spent like the best part of 2 months until it was done.
You just chewed through it.
Yep, same with Leviathan and a number of other large works.
I don't know, Prudential. Have you been badgered into reading Human Action by the libertarians yet?
I read bits and pieces of it in college. I've actually read The Great Fiction though in its entirety.
Yes.
About a year ago, so I can probably do more on that. But no, I have not finished Human Action. I'm currently buried in maybe 3 or 4 other texts right now, but my reading list continues to grow all of my interactions.
Oh god, yeah. What are you currently reading? You don't mind me asking.
I am currently going through a few academic articles, primarily on constructivist realism, which I think will actually be very fitting for today's discussion. And then I'm touching some dangerous American history texts, like Pollard's Southern History of the War. So some Civil War stuff will come out later on the channel.
Right,
but that's like an 800-page tome.
I'm trying to work. Yeah, we've constructed quite the bookshelf at our house, haven't we, Evelyn? I'm trying to work through the Juvenile that's currently there. I'm up to Sovereignty.
I was going to say, every time I speak to any of my American friends about the Civil War, they always call it the War of Northern Aggression.
Oh, rightly so.
How many? I suppose how many? The question then becomes, how many Southerners are you talking to?
Mostly Southerners, yeah, actually.
Well, then, yeah, Georgians and Texans. It's the war between the states, or the War of Northern Aggression. In places where I live, you can drive maybe like 40 minutes down the road and you'll find some like plaque next to a tree saying, like, on this day in 1861, a bunch of like Unionist sympathizers were hung. So plenty of history when it comes to that. I mean, Texas literally threw out its own government so it could join the Confederacy.
No, some of the best stuff that I've actually read on the Mises websites, the best lectures I've seen them do, are on the kind of Reconstruction era, and some of the shit that went on in the United States during that. We'll have to do some sort of Civil War stream at some point. That's probably far in the future.
But we do have Patrick Newman's Cronyism downstairs, I believe.
Yes, we do. Somebody actually bought that for us, so thank you, anonymous donator, who sent me a little bit more than that book cost and was like, "Buy this book." So I just got a donation.
The
Misery
Grove advertising approach of buy book.
Yeah, I was going to say he's pretty open to going on people's streams as well. So if we could come up with an idea of it, we could probably pitch him like a few pages of notes and be like, yeah, what can you discuss your book in relation to the Civil War?
Well, it's funny you mentioned The Great Fiction. I've read The Great Fiction and Democracy: The God That Failed as well. I have actually read those in their entirety now, because I really needed to for our series.
I'm just trying to imagine you reading the sections on methodology in the middle of this book, that, and then all the stuff on risk and uncertainty.
It's not that bad, honestly.
It's very dense, though.
It's very dense, but if you read it slowly and reread it, it's not that bad. It's just a bit dry. It's like eating like a full packet of cream crackers.
Stop, Mr. Rob.
The thing that Evelyn was talking about the... Both Evelyn and Trigger, about the state ownership, now that it's sort of this national entity, that also has a major impact on how the scholarship and sort of the methodology of how international relations is conceived. Even before what we know is like the managerial revolution, you now start to really think in these terms of grand strategy, as well as the preservation of state sovereignty. So like at the beginning, when Trigger was talking about the Russia-Ukraine thing, like, what is the grand strategy of the United States post-Cold War, right? We sort of see it as this through line about maintaining containment akin to the Cold War. But now it's just under the guise of illiberal state actors because, you know, the USSR doesn't exist. And when state ownership starts to be of like the military, we have standing armies, we start viewing things both in terms of economics, so there's the risk factor, right? But at the same time, there's also the, you know, focus heavily now becomes about management of people, management of technologies, the procurement, trade. Like one of the biggest causes for war that is suggested, of course, is by these material concerns. So that's where you start getting this school of realism that emerges, especially post-World War II from Morgenthau, Politics Among Nations. More realistically, more recently, I should say, the realists now view the world sort of as a great powers sense because things are so anathematized from like the private ownership of a military. And the best one, I think, for on the economic side would be Dale C. Copeland. He wrote a great book called, I think it's Economic Interdependence in War, and he argues that it really boiled down to, at that point with states, what is the expectation of your level of trade that can then sort of determine the likelihood of conflict? Not necessarily, oh, two nations trade with each other, free trade equals peace. No, it's the expectation.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting to see that in this bit of hopper that we've got in front of us here, there is a direct answer to the question or the issue that Mises posits. I mean, he says, you know, why is this movement away from a tendency for peace to a tendency for war? And it comes about at the same time that we have the example that, or the sort of systems Hopper looks at it as, the, you know, you go from kings that are private owners to sort of temporary caretakers and elected officials, and the no longer, as he describes it, the owner of a resource is concerned about the current income to be derived from the resource and the capital value embodied in it as a reflection of expected future income. His interests are long run with a concern for the preservation and enhancement of the capital values embodied in his country. In contrast, caretaker of a resource, viewed as public rather than private property, is concerned primarily about his current income and pays little or no attention to capital values. The empirical upshoot of this different incentive structure is that monarchical wars tend to be moderate and conservative as compared to democratic wars. And again, this is this notion that wars of a sort of pre-industrial age were very much, you know, a war with a tendency to peace, whereas now it's a war with a tendency to more war if they can get away with it.
Yes,
that sort of goes back to that inversion, right?
Mm.
So go on. You're saying
that was it? Just the inversion, right, between war being for profit, and now that war is the creator of income.
What war is the business?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, as you were, you talk about the process. Like, the mind must first be nationalized, and then it must be globalized.
that is
the trajectory it must take. And yeah, it's amazing that we take for granted. We think about this. Oh, you know, NATO's going to fight Russia, and we think about these abstract entities and their strategies. When, you know, even pre-World War I, that wouldn't have made really much sense to people. People didn't think like that. Like, the way we think, it has been like mutated by geopolitics. It's like a mind virus.
Yep.
We have become geopolitical beings who think in these terms. When you, it's really just to do with elite squabbles in many cases, or as you talked about, the realism and just the factors of expectation of trade and an equation, essentially a bean counter is doing of like whether or not this war will be profitable. Well, by their own definition, but it's insane to think that we can know a lot of these factors as individuals as well. I think a lot of people's positing on in geopolitics and the way that the media portrays it is in, you know, it's not even a circus. It's more of like a fever dream. I'm trying to think. The quote you read's different to the one that's in the document, I think.
No, I was reading a little bit more just to contextualize before we go on further. I mean, it should hopefully be familiar to those who watch the stream on Hopper's What Must Be Done, because it's the same sort of inversion that he's talking about there.
Because the actual quote, which is from, I think, 245?
Yeah, you can...
Page 245 in The Great Hipption? The Great Fiction.
It is very hip, to be fair.
It is. He says that monarchical wars typically arose out of inheritance disputes brought on by a complex network of interdynastical marriages. They were characterized by tangible territorial objectives. They were not ideologically motivated quarrels. The public considered war the king's private affair, to be financed and executed with his own money and military forces. Moreover, as conflict between different ruling families, kings felt compelled to recognize a clear distinction between combatants and non-combatants and target their war efforts exclusively at each other and their family estates. I think that's a little oversimplified, as you've already kind of not rebutted it, but added some context to this already, Prudentialist. But he does, like, it's funny when you talk about, when he's mentioned the Reformation, because it really, you could really call that, like, maybe the first public war in Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be inclined to agree.
I mean, yeah.
These guys are getting some water there. I'm pretty dry.
You could kind of look at that almost in the same way that, I mean, this is one of the other things I was tempted to bring into the stream, but by the time I put the notes together, we already had quite a lot, was stuff from Schmidt on the theory of partisanship, because I think what he views in his understanding of differing levels of combatant strategy from outside the state is the attempt time and time again to generate a more totalizing social order that can subsume the current state and in doing so conquer some larger enemy in the process. And that seems to be partly what, you know, Lenin becomes one of these sort of key figures of class war dynamics, and as far as Schmidt is concerned, he comes up with a new theory of how to engage in partisanship, and then Mao takes that a stage further by, you know, not just engaging in necessarily class warfare, but just complete public disorder for the purpose of taking out his enemies.
Sorry, my headphone was off there. The Cultural Revolution and, like, the varying, like, levels of insanity that came after it is almost like, you could say, it's almost like a domestic level total war.
Mm.
It's civil war theater without there actually being a civil war. It's like the effects of total war without, like, the military conflict. It's an extremely strange kind of pure thing to look at when you look at it. But it's engaging in geopolitics within a country, which is quite an interesting way to frame it. But that's really what was done there. It's all these, like, abstractions of enemy inside and outside groups and all of this political will that's just directed not at winning a conflict, but keeping the wheels on the thing. I don't know. Once we get there, the Cultural Revolution needs to be looked at in great detail, because it is something that is often overlooked as just, like, look at the bad things the communists did, and, like, not studied as, like, it's amazing politicking in service of treading water, essentially. Mm. And that's just what they needed to do to keep the whole show going. To keep those disparate groups, as I think we talked about the other day, that China is basically just an invented country, and someone just drew a line on a map about where they thought the Han Empire was at one point. Because that's what the British and the rest of the Europeans did. It's like, China's just kind of over here because we read some scrolls and some papers that said this was the Han Empire. So yeah, that's China now. And to keep that disparate area together supposedly moving in the same direction, comrade, took all the energy that the Cultural Revolution involved.
Mm.
But I don't know. I don't want to get too sidetracked with that.
But we did do an awful lot of drawing lines on maps and going, right there, that'll do.
This one's Shell, that's BP, that's Texaco.
Starbucks.
Here lies the tea. We sell opium to these guys.
Tell you what, I'll go on to the next quote then, since there's so many here. Yes. In blurring the distinction between this is page 274, so not far after in the Great Fiction, after the last quote.
247, I think, but yes.
247, yes. In blurring the distinction between the rulers and the ruled, we all rule ourselves, in quotes, democracy strengthened the identification of the public with a particular state. rather than dynastic prosperity disputes, which could be resolved through conquest and occupation, democratic wars became ideological affairs, clashes of civilizations, which could only be resolved through cultural, linguistic, or religious domination, subjugation, and if necessary, extermination. It became increasingly difficult for members of the public to extricate themselves from personal involvement in war. Resistance against higher taxes to fund a war was considered treasonous because the democratic state, unlike a monarchy, was owned by all. Conscription became the rule rather than the exception, and with mass armies of cheap and hence easily disposable conscripts fighting for national goals and ideals, backed by the economic resource of an entire nation, all distinctions between combatants and non-combatants fell by the wayside. Collateral damage was no longer an unintended side effect, but became an integral part of warfare. Again, he's hinting at a little bit as well, the reverse of that, which is the fact that under a more feudal system, that a lord would want to have taxes from the land that he conquered, so why would he destroy it? It seems like a very simple point to make, but it's something I think most people miss when they look at the march of history.
But it is very telling that as the... I mean, even though there was obviously a very racial component to World War II, World War II was just as much a war of ideologies as it was nations. And it, as we move into the Cold War and the framework that we're in just now, it is almost purely, you know, as he describes it, this clash of warring ideological civilizations.
It's the justification shifts from something tangible and limited, like he says, to something esoteric and, you know, on knowingly open-ended. Deliberately open-ended.
Mm. And normally...
Well, socially constructing a vagary, right? What, you know, a vague definition of civilization, a vague definition of the enemy, or not to go too far into maybe a sociology department, but to otherize what you're intending to conquer or to totalize to gain, you know, economically, or to get someone into a pretty position of power to sit on the board. This expands drastically under democratic systems, and we can see that really post Napoleon, as the Vienna system tries desperately to maintain a peace against a rising democratic and liberal wave, which in turn comes to the end in the great tragedy that is the First World War, because the only time really when Europe is beginning to seriously look at outside external enemies outside of the continent, right, and this is the one through line that I think you can see from maybe the feudal monarchical system to present day, is the civilizational factor. Because, you know, during the time of the 19th century, what question is being posed? The Eastern question is being posed. How do we handle, or how are we going to carve up, and how are we going to deal with the Ottoman Empire? These sort of things I do think are indeed a very through line throughout not only just recent history, but also ancient history as well.
I'm glad you mentioned the othering there, because again, we can get back into Schmidt with this. Because if you've got, say, a limited conflict between two aristocrats, and they say, you know, Lord von Bergenberg or whatever it is, he took the town here, and this town is historically ours, and he will give the town back, or he will pay his reparations. It's a very limited thing, because either the town gets retaken, or a fee gets paid, and everyone goes back home. It's not, you know, in that part of the world is evil. You don't need to like friend enemy distinction quite a large amount of people to engage in that kind of old world conflict. But like I said, in a sociological sense, in a new world conflict, you have to say anyone who is within that, you know, legal fiction line on a map is pure evil, and you must go and kill them.
Even not the jihads, but even the conquest and the crusades over to the Middle East was, you know, we're going to retake the Holy Land. It wasn't so much, sort of, yes, it was bringing Christianity over there, but there was an awful lot of the people were working with one another over there. It wasn't all brown people are bad, let's kill them all. There was, you know, this is still very, very new, even though because I can see the Crusades being used as an example of that happening in prehistory. But even then, it was an ideological, if you want, rather than, or as well as a religious thing, rather than all of these people are evil, let's kill them.
Hmm. Well, the Templars, even in their wildest fever dreams, never had the aim of marching on Mecca or, you know.
No. The Templars were working with Bani Hassan, who was the original assassins group over there. They were working with certain Muslim groups to overthrow other Muslim groups that were a little more oppressive than the more ones that would happily work with the Templars.
Mm. No, it's a point that we discussed towards the end of the events of World War II and the democratization series, that between sort of the turn of the century and 1945 is, you know, Prud was talking before about that, the Napoleonic kind of structure of democratic government that just seemed to become this monolith taking what it wanted in Europe. It then took on the form of a myth, and that myth is consolidated in the events of World War I and World War II. And it's kind of funny, as I put in the notes here, you know, Hopper recognises that the effect that Mises seems to have glossed over is not just the economic influence of the state that pushes the development of war, or total war. The very involvement of the masses within the political process is just as important and is a primary necessity for the development of ideological war justifications, not just economic. Hence, as he goes on to discuss now, the doctrine of democratic peace, which I just think is amazing.
Well, it's, I know Jess ordered the fourth political theory, didn't she? Mm. She's got Dugin's book. Because I've read excerpts from it. I've not read the whole thing. But I think the quote that a lot of people have from that is that total peace is just as murderous as total war, which is a great, I don't know, it's a great soundbite, but it's also very true. And it's, I don't know, it's almost Hopper sounding here, because he's talking about the doctrine of total peace, which is the same thing.
Mm.
It's that, you know, the idea of a totalizing peace is just as powerful as the idea of a totalizing war. As we talked about during, you know, the end of World War II, and the idea that the Allies have the ability to announce the fact that there is now world peace.
Mm.
not in like a Sam Hyde sense, but
world peace.
I don't know. Do you want to go on to this, read this quote?
Yeah, I can. I'll go from just the one above. What appears to be standing in the way of peace and civilization, then, is above all the state and democracy, and specifically the world's model democracy, the United States. Ironically, if not surprisingly, however, it is precisely the United States which claims it is the solution to the quest for peace. The reason for this claim is the doctrine of democratic peace, which goes back to the days of Woodrow Wilson and World War I, has been revived in recent years by George W. Bush and his neoconservative advisors, and by now has become intellectual folklore even in liberal libertarian circles. The theory claims democracies do not go to war against each other. Hence, in order to create a lasting peace, the entire world must be made democratic, and, as a largely unstated corollary, today many states are not democratic and resist internal democratic reform. Hence, war must be waged on those states in order to convert them to democracy, and thus create lasting peace. I mean, this is just Schmitt coming at the wazoo. But it's nice to see that he is almost kind of implicitly saying here as well that this is one of the kind of lasting liberal myths.
Yes. It's something that a lot of people regurgitate as well when they talk about democracy as an abstract virtue for a government.
Mm.
It's a lot of the stuff that he goes into in detail in Democracy of the God That Failed, obviously. But it's this myth of history that has been actually quite irregular. Like I said, it was Woodrow Wilson, to a degree FDR, then it was kind of buried for a little bit as the clash of the Soviet Union and the kind of the Western liberal hegemony went on, and the idea of containment rather than rollback, because they liked having the enemy there. But the idea that you must go and you must democratize people, you know, we will bring you peace by force if necessary.
It's democracy manifest.
Yeah, succulent Chinese meal, yes. That's a great clip.
It is.
But this is, I don't know, this... Sorry, go on.
Oh, no. What I would add, though, right, is that we consider these myths because they're values. They're political formulas, to borrow a little bit from Pareto. And if I could bring in maybe some outside text from the notes that I think would kind of play well. This is from a gentleman named Barry Posen, who I believe is over in one university in California. His name it escapes me, but he wrote a book not too long ago called Restraint, A New Foundation for U.S. Grand Strategy. And he's sort of calling out the liberal hegemonic doctrinaire. And he says, I'll read here, the spread of these values for the U.S. in particular, including democratic governance within nation states, individual rights, free markets, and a free press, as well as the rule of law, are essential to U.S. security. The view is that the United States can only truly be safe in a world full of states like us, as so long the United States has the power to pursue this outcome, it should. The notion that U.S. foreign policy should try to spread these values has a complex history. It originates instrumentally with Woodrow Wilson, but intellectually goes back to the earliest ideas about the United States relative to the West of the world, as a progressive example it provided. These ideas were given new energy by victory over the Soviet Union, and a sudden realization that the United States might actually have sufficient power to spread its ideas about domestic governance and the international order abroad.
I mean, not to go down a rabbit hole all of a sudden, but I think it's maybe there is another kind of relationship we can grab out of that you're saying the reason that Woodrow Wilson and George W. Bush has these ideas is because they're ultimately tapping into what is an essentially an American myth, and that American myth is, whether you want to look at it in that way or not, it was fueled by a group of people who thought that they were going to build the new world, and they built that new world in the image of values of Rosicrucianism and Puritan Protestantism and Freemasonry, and it then becomes no sort of a strange coincidence then that the people that we're discussing here, both Woodrow Wilson and George W. Bush and some of the other people that get brought up, are still related to what essentially are sort of secret societies like Skull and Bones and whatever have you.
I would also add that, since you kind of mentioned the religious aspect, right, that there's two sides to that coin of the American tradition, and I think that if you like you said, you guys have kind of gone over the Second World War, I'd imagine that you would know about the prelude, about just the massive amount of the anti-war sentiment that exists within the American psyche. It still does to this day. Unfortunately, the people that have it, which is the regular folk, don't really get their voices heard on that issue. But it kind of also goes back to what I mentioned at the beginning, with sort of the filiatism thing, also kind of just known as this new Israelism, right? You know, Spain had the Rex Catholicis, the most Catholic king, the French, I think it was the first daughter of the church, the Holy Roman Empire, each trying to apply a national identity, a totality, right? The public rather than the private. Now into these ecclesiastical affairs. And so we want to make the world safe for democracy, onward Christian soldiers, or George W. Bush invoking scripture in order to respond to September 11th in 2001. It is very much alive, I would say, post-Reformation, but at least for the United States, especially post-English Civil War.
Well, see, that's why I really like this text from Hopper. This is, I think, it's a slightly different outside look at the usual stuff you get on sort of ANCAP self-defense, because there's also subtle critiques of sort of democracy and liberalism within here. However, I just love the title heading, Making the World Safe from Democracy, or How to Defend Oneself Against the United States. And then just the first paragraph is, after this excursion into the theory of democratic peace, I am back to the proposition that there is no greater threat to lasting peace than the democratic state, and in particular the United States. Thus the question is, how to defend oneself against the US? The great, down with the great good Satan. Time, I'm gonna go get my sandals and slap pictures of George Bush.
Well, there's a very recent idea to bring it back to the Ukraine conflict. The idea, as it's been described, it was described both in 2014 and in the most recent conflict. The phrase and the refrain is, the Ukraine is America's backyard, which is hilarious. But it's exactly that. It's a very similar.
Pop a boat to the Mississippi and take the junction at the Danube.
I can't remember who said it right now. I think it was someone like Hillary Clinton, or it was just one of the globalists just comes out and says, yeah, you know, policy wise, Ukraine is America's backyard. But it's the idea is echoed by someone who's supposed to be like a right wing, like radical, like Dan fucking Crenshaw, who's insufferable. But he went on to describe Afghanistan as America's flank, in quotes, which perfectly echoes Franklin Roosevelt's the quote he denied saying, because it wasn't, you know, people can say it openly now, but it was unpalatable for even the great FDR to say that the frontier of America is on the Rhine. He supposedly said this in 1939. But you have, you know, the Democrat left saying, you know, Ukraine is America's backyard. You have the supposed bleeding edge of the Republican right saying that Afghanistan is America's flank. And you have FDR, who represents kind of the, you know, the first line of the New World Democrats, saying that the frontier of America is on the Rhine. All of these figures share the same mindset. Like a fucking stroke there, which I just described as like, it's like this. It's Faustian liberalism throughout the entirety of the supposed political spectrum. And it's this idea that, like, where America goes, so does civilization. And it's taken for granted that the America is the end point of this great development. It's another theme in Dugan's book, whereas there's this... I'm writing this incredibly long at this point. It's like 3,000-word article called The American Disease, in which I go into in great detail that the idea that the Afghani goat farmer might actually prefer to be sitting in a cave studying the Quran rather than working a 40-hour week at Taco Bell to go home and watch cat videos. And that idea just cannot cross the collective American conscious mind. Otherwise, it would collapse in on itself. They are on like a meta sense, on like a kind of macro level. American culture can't think that, and it can't espouse that, because it would collapse otherwise.
Well, as the American on the panel, what I would argue, though, is that, again, it sort of goes back to the old American adage about the people versus its government. Its elites can't imagine that. And this is why you get the few people that have a freaking brain in between their ears in the United States Congress, like Rand Paul, for instance. He called it out years ago, the son of Ron. Where he was just like, you cannot honestly tell me as a policymaker that you can find some gentleman in the middle of a cave in Iraq and turn him into Thomas Jefferson in 3 days. It doesn't happen, right? And this is the problem.
My Fair Muller, yes.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, My Fair Muller, indeed. And this is the problem, especially after the end of the conflict with the Soviet Union, is because you have this sort of endpoint Fukuyama-esque end of history. Wherein America's grand strategy kind of emerges between these four rivaling ideas. And to borrow back from Posen, these ideas were cooperative security, American primacy, selective engagement, and isolationism. And of course, after September 11th, what really kicks it off is that it's cooperative security and primacy. You're either with us or you're against us. And that's what kind of makes this all rather just sort of tragic, because yes, there's these people that want to say that it's the flank or their backyard. And to an extent, you see the rivalry aspect of that coming out of, say, those like Dugin about having a Eurasianist bloc or China's aspect of a Middle Kingdom. This is what makes geopolitics a very interesting study. And this is why I fall more within the realist school of things. Because in 1992, right after the fall of the Soviet Union, arguably one of the most towering scholars of the modern day is John J. Mearsheimer. And he writes this book called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. And he says, what's the tragedy is not that it's that, you know, nations are, you know, what they are. The tragedy is that nations that in an anarchic state inevitably pursue empire. Then he's referring to the nation state itself as we interpret it, you know, a government, a standing military and whatnot, which whether it's democratic, illiberal or authoritarian. And what makes it so depressing is that as long as states like those exist, which inevitably they will until something happens, that they will inevitably pursue that kind of conflict. That nations with the capability to project power will think about far-off places as their backyard or flank.
The sort of final point that I was wanting to work towards, or the stuff that we've got here, that I hope is somewhat evident through Mises and Hoppe, and will now possibly be answered by our old favourite C.A. Bond's Nemesis, which is a spectacular book that says way more than it really should for a small 180-page book about the juvenile.
It's a very dense tome,
but the most important prerequisite for geopolitical theory is that there is more than one warring nation. That there is actually more than one territory in the earth that you can refer to as that's owned by such and such. And as we move towards, you know, global organization, the League of Nations, the Council of Foreign Relations, you know, these organizations that are attempting to essentially centralize military organization into one organization so that the states then have to essentially act democratically and a sort of unilateral egalitarian fashion, that they then have to come to decisions and meetings and briefings and all this sort of nonsense about, you know, what's NATO going to do, what are these groups going to do, and it becomes that very bean countery complex thing that we're talking about before. But in doing so, when all these different aspects are discussed and all these different strategies are explained, there is they seem to miss the point that, well, why is all this strategy coming from the one place? And it's, you know, the way they're going to solve that problem, and I think as Bond is, we're going to read through here, is through going to war with an abstraction. Completely going to war with an abstraction. I think we could maybe just start here and we can continue on with the point as we go through, because there's quite a bit to read here, but this section and the latter section, when connected together, I see them as a bit of a kind of bombshell against the idea that, especially since World War II, that national geopolitics has ever really been a thing, that much of that has just been a facade, and that, as we'll see in the latter portion, it might be the case that we've had a global order of geopolitics since that time, and that all we've watched in front of us, essentially, as you said, like stage shows earlier on, these aren't real enemies. When he starts here talking about the concept of human rights developing in the 18th century and the application in which these rights were put forth as self-evident, as seen in the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with a certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, this is one of those things we could probably sit and talk for ages and ages about all the problems of this sentence, but if we at least just think about this as an aspect of the American tradition that can be used towards some kind of global uniformity.
Where in Nemesis is this? What page are we on?
This is page 52 in Nemesis.
Ah, yeah, okay.
There should be a note in it. But just people talk about the fact that, you know, America has always been some kind of global force, or America has always been the centre of globalisation. And there are some arguments to that being true, but I think you can at least say, from what we're going to look at here, that American tradition has been adopted by globalism, which is maybe a more fair case. I don't know if Proop wants to give some sort of response to that or not.
I would say, especially after the Second World War, you sort of establish an institution, right? Of course, it originates in the League of Nations, which the U.S. famously never joins, but post-war, you've watched the complete destruction of any potential European power to counter you, and in the East, Japan and China have been devastated both by civil conflict and by getting nuked twice. That, yeah, why not create institutions in your own democratic image in order to maintain that power and have it as a values and rules-based system? But the American tradition, I would say, like I said earlier in the stream, is that I really think FDR is where that tradition, almost in an essence of some kind of prosperity gospel, really changes. Because if you really want a good piece of what the old American tradition and what is sort of like the old right that Marie Rothbard calls, the essay Ex America and the Rise of Empire by Garrett Garrett kind of really highlight what the American tradition was, which really was an isolationist. We came here to form this country, not to be a global power, but to escape the conflict and the religious issues of Europe. And unfortunately, that has gone by the wayside. And the last time that it really came up, I Trump, of course, isn't a religious man, but I really do think it was Pat Buchanan when he ran for the last time in 92 as a Republican, because that was the last vestiges of that American tradition of isolation, not wanting to be involved, restraint. It gets so much more complex now, right? Because there's nuclear weapons, there's terrorism, there's institutions. But there, you have the elite, and then you have what the cultural heritage of the people were. And to me, it's a really great tragedy to see that being erased now for this sort of, you know, let's make the country just a giant strip mall and invade the world and invite the world.
It's, I don't know who coined it, but the term I love is McWorld.
Yeah, jihad versus McWorld.
Yeah, it's the McWorld is, you know, you end up with the McCountry, and then it starts to become the McWorld.
The McClub.
I'm glad you mentioned Pat Buchanan, because there's that whole stuff that we kind of peeked into, which is essentially Sam Francis, like, basically trying to grab Buchanan and shake him and telling him, like, not to disavow the old conservatism and to just go harder, to just go balls out and hit them as hard as possible. And that was his own, you know, that being his only hope. Essentially, it's Sam Francis telling Buchanan not to cuck out. Yep. which unfortunately he didn't listen to. He did moderate some of his positions and try and appeal to kind of the Reaganite zeitgeist that was still lingering in the air like a bad fart. But that's, I don't know, Pat Buchanan's someone people forget. And I guess the only quote-unquote third-party candidate most people remember these days is either Gary Johnson or Ralph Nader. So.
Ron Paul.
Well, yeah, you remember him.
I still remember 2012.
Unfortunately, most people don't.
I remember. I just remember the RNC changing the rules last minute to screw him.
Yes.
No, I think there's the. I was mentioning it. There's the classic of him talking to Rudy Giuliani in like an RNC debate in like 2004. And he starts asking Giuliani questions about 9/11, as if Giuliani knew it was going to happen. And it's like, oh my God, Mr. Paul, they're going to shoot you. Stop. You can't say that.
Ron Paul being like, you dirty bastard, I know what you people did.
But if you want, going back to that internationalism, this human rights thing, if you really want a good modern day example of this, it's sort of the idea of what is known as democratic peace, right? There's that great article, I think it was from Thomas Friedman of the New York Times in the 90s, and he puts it out, and he's just like, you know, democratic states, they typically don't go to war with each other, they're not inclined to intervene in the affairs of others, and then like 3 days later, the United States is bombing parts of Bosnia. So that, yeah, that lasted maybe three good days before it was empirically disproven there.
You can't let the Serbs get in on the monopoly of bombing muzzies. Anyway.
That's you can't do that. That's a US business.
Yeah.
Are you essentially saying that, well, when you talked about the idea of there being a de facto almost one world order after World War II, all that came to mind in the reframing of this was the police action in Vietnam, as it was called at first. And this idea of, you know, the UN peacekeeping, as much of a joke as it is, you know, the operations, as they're so dryly referred to, in places like Bosnia or Afghanistan or Iraq or, you know, Libya or Syria or any of these places where, you know, the military operations have taken place. And yeah, you're under an explicit one world government, the putting down of a popular rebellion would be seen as a literal police action. And it's interesting the way things have already been framed like that. Because
even earlier, Scrump, think Korean War, where
yes.
UN articles were invoked.
Yes. Yep. It's. Again, the Korean War is something we're going to have to get to when we continue on with the time period stuff, because it's essentially the Chinese and the Americans play fighting and trying not to get into a position where it makes, not that either of them would actually use nuclear weapons, but they don't want to get into a position where it would make them look like they wouldn't, so that people understand that the whole mutually assured destruction thing is actually kind of a wink and a nod between everybody. Because there's so much stuff about the Korean War, about generals on essentially both sides being told, stop what you're doing, you're winning too fast.
Very much so, yes.
Both the Chinese and the Americans at different points had their leashes pulled, which is intriguing.
Yes, and you've got Russia basically testing weapons over there, lending out brand new MiGs to the Chinese and the Koreans to play with.
Funny story about the MiGs, the British government gave them all the technical specs engine.
Dude, I know. I know quite a lot about aerospace. Yeah. Yes. Those were a gift by Churchill. Yes, because America was like, oh, what the fuck are they? Excuse my French, but what the hell are these things? These aren't supposed to exist. And England was sat there going, oops, sorry.
In the same way that the Mujahideen have to be able to defend Afghanistan, and that's why all that military equipment was left there. Mm-hmm. They have to be a viable fighting force in the absence of of NATO.
We'll get to that and its importance.
But I'm just saying, in the same way, I know I'm going to spoil this, but the Soviet Union at the end of World War II, even when it is threatening to shoot down Allied aircraft over Berlin, they're still getting massive technical and resource assistance from these same people, from the US, from Britain, from, the quote-unquote, their Western allies still. And it's the same reason that the Soviet Union, post-World War II, was in danger of not being a viable fighting force because it has exhausted itself so heavily, and that it was being resupplied long after the cessation of hostilities and well into what would we consider the proto-Cold War period, because they needed to be able to hold all these territories. And then America could sit back and go, well, we're going to do our containment thing by Eastern Europe. see you in the 90s.
So we don't end up waiting to get round to it, because there's quite a bit here to go through, but I think it's quite important. This chapter that we're actually looking at the moment is referred to as, I think it's just The Individual. Yeah. But it is Bond's sort of general thesis that the individual is very much a creation of the state, or the creation of a central order, and that it's one of the sort of the greatest appeals to power that can be made is to this abstract idea of the individual.
Well, it's like the allure that you put on Twitter the other day.
But he goes on here, these self-evident rights were used as a means to undermine monarchical authority and, in the case of the United States of America, states right in the name of the people. Which is, the sort of juvenile or sort of centre, subsidiary and groups on the sort of periphery. We have the soon-to-be emerging primary institution of the United States government appealing to this tertiary abstract class of the individual and self-determination so that it can subsume power from what would have been a secondary institution at the time, the colonial government of the King of Britain, or England, as it were. But that model can then get used nowadays. He continues on, the second development of note can be seen with the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This document was drawn up for the UN in the wake of World War II by a transnational elite with clear aspirations to world governance, that it should appeal to all of humanity and should deign to grant to all equality as well as a newly minted collective identity, seems very much like a repetition of James Madison's invention of the American people. In this case, it is not the sovereignty of individual continental states being targeted, but rather that of nation states. Finally, a much less recognised development of human rights occurred in the early 1970s. This last development is of special importance, as it is not widely known beyond specialised histories of human rights, and only clearly comes to light upon recognising the connection between conflict and the expansion of individualising culture. A review of Google's Ngram for the term human rights provides us with our first clue as to this development, and it shows that a significant increase in the use of the term occurred following 1973. In line with the Juvenalian model, we should be able to point out a Juvenalian conflict at this time, and the adoption of this term by a set of institutions as a means to undermine other centres of power. At this time, elites in the UN and specific elements of American power structure began to focus on the concept of human rights as a means to undermine the legitimacy of Latin dictatorships, communist regimes, and most importantly, the foreign policies of the Republican presidency of Richard Nixon. This final point of conflict is central, and well within the Juvenalian dynamic of rival centres engaging in conflict over political centralisation. Human rights were not first devised and then implemented, they were raised to prominence by the needs of particular actors in the midst of conflict. It's clear Apodaca writes of structural conflict's importance to the adoption of human rights in 1970s. American foreign policy and understanding US human rights policy, a paradoxical legacy, oh, it's very long-winded. Human rights policy was not an intentionally planned strategy. Congress saddled presidential foreign and domestic policy initiatives with human rights mandates in order to restrain the immoral, if not illegal, behaviour of an imperial president, which is a sort of slightly masked up admittance that the agreement with these international bodies and their charters and whatever else is a move to further the ideological monopolization of the American state, so that its federal aspects and its judicial and its an executive and its, you know, all these different branches ultimately become worth nothing, because the check for power is no longer these different institutions, but the ideology held within them.
Yeah, it's the, they didn't want Nixon to have power, so they, you know, they basically elevated it to a supranational level when it was convenient to them.
Mm-hmm.
They really did, they divested the power center as a power structure when someone was occupying it they didn't like.
Mm.
It's the same thing that happened with Trump as well. Both are great examples of how if you do not, you know, hold within the very narrow confines of the hegemonic thought of the current elite, that you will have your power by hook or by crook divested from you in some way.
Yes. When they own everything, like from the media to the military to every other part of the deep state, if you will, coming in as a bit of an outsider and going, lol, democracy actually worked this time and I got elected in. Yeah, they are going to remove everything they can from.
You know, if anything, you talk about how paranoid Nixon was with a list of enemies, but like, He was right. If anything, he was slightly more, you know, too conservative towards them. If he wanted to get anything done, you know, instead of just going to China and talking to them, he should have studied the, you know, the Cultural Revolution a bit better.
Maoist Nixonianism.
If anything, Nixon didn't go far enough with his enemies.
That sounds a bit right to me.
People very rarely do go far enough with their enemies. One of the things the communists know how to do well. Things they went too far, by and large.
No, they just didn't go far enough yet again.
Yeah, it's you talk about the Democratic Congress talking about the rampant violation of human rights, the need for an effective response for both the United States and the world community, and that every time we see conflict being fomented by these internationalist forces, like the human rights like horse is you know, dragged out and flogged a bit more.
Mm. Well, no, this that's is really that's a great continuation almost to the sort of color revolutions we looked at in the stream we did, funnily enough, on sort of again looking at geopolitics but from a domestic political sort of perspective, that, you know, the fake colour revolutions that happen over there happen here now, and that the model that he's going to go in and discuss here. You know, this report also called for greater promotion of the concept of human rights in the UN and beyond, something which was evidently achieved. This complicated institutional conflict created a rather odd situation, wherein elements of the US governmental structure were engaged in serious conflict with each other, while at the same time engaging foreign actors in two distinct ways. The presidency, under the influence of Henry Kissinger, enacted fairly standard state-to-state diplomacy on the basis of a worldview which saw foreign affairs as the preserve of sovereign states, while Congress, the State Department, and actors in the UN engaged in a subversive appeal to an international human individual. Among this second group, a further set of institutions comes to light when we apply the Juvenalian model. The non-governmental foundations, with the Ford Foundation being especially notable. I can hear A.A. Rean from here, over in Wales, as he decries Henry Ford's racist money being wasted on globalist projects. These foundations formed a formidable source of revenue, by which elites connected with the Democratic Party faction could institutionalise human rights independent of governmental channels. These foundations, being private, were free to dispose of their significant funds without taxation and were used extensively as tools of foreign policy by specific elements of this elite. The adoption of human rights by the Ford Foundation proves instructive in how these institutions were linked. I mean, it's this point that we can see that as state monopoly almost becomes subsumed by ideological monopoly, we then have this bringing in almost in a fascist sort of attitude of different aspects of the private sector so that they can force through whatever backlogs are being caused in the state mechanisms and the quote-unquote accountable mechanisms that they're supposed to go through.
It very much is, as we see today, that there are these vast alignment between government, you know, NGO and private sector we see today was, you know, in its not even its prototypical state, but was in a state to influence policy back in the 70s.
You
know, it didn't do so in such a routine degree. This is a bit more of an extraordinary case with someone like Nixon, but we see now kind of the allyship between the government, its plausible deniability of essentially laundering rhetoric and ideology with NGOs, and then using that to appeal to like a peripheral sense of the people. It's very common today. We see it, you know, it's almost blasé to talk about, you know, X Foundation, the Clinton Foundation, you know, we've got the Gates Foundation, you've got the Open Society stuff, you've got Black Lives Matter, who recently got in trouble. You've got all these, you know, we are awash in a sea of government bosom NGOs. But this was really the first time it had managed to, at least in the US, force through national level change.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's also interesting that, you know, the traditional liberal model of history has already painted Nixon as the ultimate post-war domestic enemy. Same with Trump as well. That anyone who creates conflict within the power structure is automatically brushed in these like cartoonish ways. Then
I'm still screaming for Trump to be arrested now. Nutcases are still going, he must be arrested. You know, for what, I'm not quite sure. It's through, you know, lock up your political enemy even after he's no longer in power. Not mad stuff. And it's because he dared to challenge the zeitgeist for hegemony.
How aware of the Juvenalian model are you, Prudentialist? I'm not sure how much.
I'm about halfway through the book on power.
Okay, fair enough. I actually read Nemesis before I read any of the Juvenal because it's quite a good primer. And I do like the way he talks about the power center and the periphery, because it's a great way, if you look at domestically the US in the 70s with, you know, the using and then throwing away of what was the burgeoning hippie movement, and how they were really used as the ideological excuse for some of the most egregious things that went on domestically when undermining the separation of powers and forcing things through. It's this old, very old, you know, kind of 1870s onwards idea that unless you do what I want, there's going to be some level of communist or peasant revolution. And you will do what me, the leftist, says, because otherwise, you know, there's going to be Lenin in the wings, comrade. That is the implicit threat of all kind of politics from the left. And this is a great example of it here with the Democratic Party operates during the Vietnam era.
Well, I think there can also be something to be said about the fact that that's also the strategy of the right, but in a slightly different way, because as we come into with this, one of the later chapters here, which has some very nice red pills in it, to be totally honest.
Do you want me to read this one?
Yeah, if you want to just go from the...
Yeah, I can talk about this. Going on for about an hour and a half already. You put so much in here, Evelyn, help. This is from page 139 of C.A. Bond's Nemesis, but it says, in 1946, partisan networks were created with the express aim of forming a ready-made resistance in the event of a Soviet land invasion of Western Europe. Many of the men recruited were members of the previous fascist or Nazi infrastructure of Germany and Italy, and other right-wing groups with a reliably anti-communist stance. These networks were supplied with weapons, training, and money by the British MI6 and the American OSS, basically, later to replace by the CIA. Its network became known as Gladio,
I think it's Italian.
Gladio. All right. And its existence was acknowledged many years after many years of secrecy when Giulio Andreotti, the Italian Prime Minister, revealed it in a speech to the Italian Parliament on October 24th, 1990. While this group was supposed to act as a stay-behind fight force in the event of a war which never came, it was instead pressed into use for more immediate needs. Especially, there is evidence and even acknowledgement for the security services that these networks were used to manipulate public opinion against communist parties and factions by committing false flag terror attacks. That is... what a red pill. All I can see are images of... Ukrainians with IWY Tavors and their blood and soil flags behind them.
Yeah,
Israel pumps them full of cash and weapons.
The NGO Nazis.
The NGO Nazis that were explicitly defended by Israel. They came even after it. There's those great news reports I think we used on a previous stream where you have someone like Netanyahu coming into bat for these groups.
Yep.
And basically telling them they may be Nazis, but they're on our side, guys. Which is just an amazing thing for an Israeli administration to come out. But it's the same dance on a different day, you know. It's same shit. When I read this, it actually didn't surprise me the slightest, because I kind of knew about this stuff already. Mm. And it also allows them to subsume these... what would be dissident groups generally into its, you know, new security state, and it allows them to be swept up in this new friend-enemy distinction.
Hmm.
Which is kind of interesting. But I don't know, is that something you'd heard about before, Prudentialist? Or had you heard about the delicious stuff with the Israelis funding the Ukrainian neo-Nazis? Because that's great.
I've heard bits and pieces. I also know that I think it was after the Second World War, with some of the situations in Greece, that I think Israel, as a formerly like created nation, also kind of got involved in supplying intel and arms. So it's not like they haven't been on the sides of former fascists and such in the past.
If I remember correctly, a lot of the, as we will again get into in a moment here, but I think this was partly omitted in Italy in the 1990s, because from through the 70s and right through the 80s, there was, you know, I know we have the sort of communist fascist street violence nowadays, but there was a lot of bombings and fire bombings and shootings and some pretty big riots that happened in Italy during these periods. And, you know, even 30, 40 years after the war, it was the same people, you know, evolved with these Gladio groups and other CIA communist organizations that took it upon themselves to try and force Italy in a Weimar sort of position. And I think I think there was almost an admittance at the time of the Italian Prime Minister being like, look, I'm so sorry, but look what the Americans have done to us. That's why we're all sitting squabbling and blowing each other up, because they're just giving us like bucket loads of money and plastic explosives and telling people to fire in.
I think people forget just how provincial a state Italy has been for so long.
Mm.
I know it's considered a very large advanced economy now, but if you look at the situation that led to the rise of Mussolini, for example, and you know the syndicalist government and essentially South Italy having its own hanging of the kulaks on a weekly basis, you start to understand why they may have craved the stability and order of a strongman. Mm. Let's say.
Well, I love that after that previous paragraph about false flags, he then goes into the completely opposite side of the situation. Where he says, in such an environment, one where committing false flag terrorism is deemed acceptable, conscious widespread involvement in all areas of culture must surely have seemed a logical and minor step in ensuring electoral control. It is therefore unsurprising that we find in this conflict the widespread acknowledged involvement of US institutions in every area of Western European culture. A perfect example of this involvement can be found in the Congress for Cultural Freedom, a CIA creation which was used to fund vast numbers of artistic and literary events and publications. Following a revelation by the New York Times this funding came from the CIA, the organization was renamed the International Association for Cultural Freedom, and the funding burden was taken up by the all-too-familiar Ford Foundation. This pattern of the same elite funding developments through either formal yet secret avenues like government agencies or through informal private entities is very helpful in disguising what is in fact the same elite cast of characters in either case. Despite this particular organisation proving abortive, there is a strong case to be made that any thinker or artist of renown in the post-war period and any movement of significance in general was ultimately patronised by the US elite nexus of intelligence services or foundations, often both at once. I mean, that's, again, like, massive red pill. And it's,
thank you, Mr. Bond, very based.
If you go from Sutton to this, it becomes, you know, as I've sort of been talking to folk about, it becomes very hard to deny the case when it is argued that the popularization of communism within Europe is a creation of the CIA and the American security state.
Well, you get very Council of Foreign Relations with it.
Yes.
Because the Council of Foreign Relations was another great vector in which international socialism was instilled in Europe by a directly US federal funded force. And the International Association of Cultural Freedom is very much a body in its kind of mold. I mean, we're almost getting towards the Frankfurt School denazification stuff here and how linked in they were with the US state apparatus in the denazification of post-war Germany. They were essentially their official ideological and philosophical, you know, underpinning when it came to that. They were the ones who set up and elevated all these people in the Frankfurt School towards essentially being the underpinnings culturally of what post-war Germany became, which is a completely false and constructed state. They're still like suffering psychic damage because of it.
Mm. Well, see, that's why.
Oops. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's why I like the idea, the title, The Politics of Geopolitics. Because you have to understand on a very subtle political level how much influence is really going on here. And that ultimately, especially in the Cold War paradigm, you can argue that there's only really one force, and it's America. And the other force is just a puppet that America keeps both sort of caged but also fed to the appropriate levels so it acts, you know, to their will. And I'd be interested to see is there any geopolitical commentary nowadays outside of that you would maybe see from like Ron Paul or Scott Horton that is consciously aware of the fact that so much of what we see in front of us is fabricated? I mean, I see it ever so slightly with some of the people now talking about stuff in Ukraine, but I think there is still an ignorance there of that, you know, from 2014 onwards, there has been a conscious effort by Western forces to destabilize Ukraine for their own benefits so that they can get closer to Russia.
I will say that Scott Horton did literally, while we were streaming this, retweet somebody saying, like, there's a Guardian article that says Russia plans very graphic fake video as pretext for Ukrainian invasion, US claims. And he's just like, oh, look, so war atrocity propaganda footage can be faked. Very interesting. it's basically exactly what we're talking about. What were you saying there, Prudentially? Sorry.
Oh, well, on the video, thank you, CIA graphic designer. Very cool. Because, there are a few people that kind of talk about it. I think they're more independent commentators. But I think this also kind of goes back to, you know, what's been talked about is like democratic elitism or even just the concept of like constructivism. Like Alexander Wendt talks about how like anarchy is what a state makes of it, right? And we have these institutions that are these public-private entities or relations with like the CIA, whether it's the Ford Foundation, that cultural freedoms one, or even more recently with the National Endowment for Democracy, which is basically doing what the CIA has been doing since the 1990s. You know, it's quite clear that if you can create a social construct of what the world is to be, in this instance, an ideological values-based system, then you can probably get away with what you want. Even Bronze Age Pervert talked about this, that throughout the Cold War, the United States was explicitly on the side of decolonialization to weaken European powers in the name of things like democratization their own concept of the UN model of the new human rights, or even just being anti-Nazi or anti-fascist. And that's what I like about Paul Gottfried, since AA recommended him.
Yeah, I was going to say
this whole thing about American foreign policy being anti-fascist, because anti-fascist is a really great way to say that, you know, we're communists in the background, and we can do what we need to do to commit atrocity and take power.
It's very much the same point that's made throughout Burnham's Suicide of the West, and especially that sort of anti-colonial focus. That even though conservatives in America were, for all intents and purposes, anti-communist, they agreed with progressivism, and because they agreed with a moderate case of progressivism, they had no leg to stand on when it came to arguing for the quote-unquote colonial powers. And that you get, as you're saying, that effect then in Gottfried, where I think Burnham describes that, you know, without anyone to frame himself as to the left or the right of, there is no liberal. You know, without the quote-unquote extreme right, these colonial forces, there is then no liberalism, because you would just otherwise be a communist.
I'm trying to find it. There's a quote, I can't remember who said it, about Thomas Sowell and how he basically regards Southern Americans pre-construction period, because there's all these people who buy into like the liberal liberal view of history to some degree or another, and like the reason that we couldn't get to, like, I know you slightly chided us when talking about that because it's kind of funny. It's it's great when you end up with these people who have these blind spots, and you have these people who are supposedly these people who see outside of the current zeitgeist, and yet they aren't willing to, like you said, they weren't willing to go as far as even some leftists are. Like, I remember a couple of weeks ago we used that, or it's nearly a month ago now, Lord, it's been a while, but that article from the Gray Zone about Philosophy Tube and Bread Tube in general, getting security state, the same security state money from the same security state NGOs that were funding like people like the White Helmets. And that all of this is just one great agitating and integrating puppet show by all this money swirling around, and all these supposedly emergent media figures, you say, are not real.
I was to say, here we go again with, I mean, it's kind of funny that to think about, but you know, Bond of all people writing this, and then his things that he says about Thiel money, it then makes you consider whether or not there is some genuine concern to have or not. But he goes on here to say that what is of special interest to us regarding this cultural clash between the Soviets and the international community, as this Anglo-American dominated sphere came to be called, is the nature of the cultural developments that it incentivized, The Juvenalian model tells that this conflict should follow a pattern wherein we can see appeals to the periphery made through calls to equality and or individuality as a means to undermine competing centres of power. And here we find this in abundance. Consider the following from a CIA draft study regarding its involvement in the aforementioned Congress for Cultural Freedom. This organisation of scholars and artists, egotistical free-thinking and even anti-American in their politics, managed to reach out from its Paris headquarters to demonstrate that communism, despite its blandishments, was a deadly foe of art and thought. No.
Oh, that's it. It's right. It was Paul Gottfried. Paul Gottfried said that Sowell writes about white Southerners the way Nazis write about Jews and black rednecks, which Jeez-o. I think is a great indictment of the man and some of his failings. Sorry, continue. Gottfried, please stop being so based.
Note that the author recognizes that the focus was on freedom and liberty, or rather, on an American interpretation of freedom and liberty as against the so-called communist blandishments. This is the connection to the UN document on human rights, or the article on human rights, that is written in the very same language as the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. And these two things become blurred as he's described this sort of Anglo-American alliance that is, as it sees itself, the international community. And it puts communism outside of that. Also, note that the US patrons were obviously more than happy to fund artists and thinkers who were in a sense anti-American as long as they were anti-communist. This was far less dangerous than it may sound, since even then, if the anti-Americanism became a problem, the patrons would be able to simply withdraw funding without funding for study, books, finance, for attending conferences, and all the other logistical requirements for cultural prominence. These artists would die and slide into obscurity. I mean, this is just, what's going to happen with BreadTube over the next 10 years once they've instituted, like, global digital ID controls and stuff like that. What use are people who whinge about minimum wage going to be to the elites anymore? None whatsoever. So, as you said, much like the hippies were in the 70s as they moved towards Vietnam, they realised, wait, we don't need you people anymore. If anything, you're a hindrance. Fuck off.
Yeah. They were kind of, you know, the heads were eventually bashed, mm-hmm. and these people came into... you know, an abrupt, ugly realization about the reality of power, and they fail to understand and learn the lessons of the fact that they have been coddled as, you know, basically the ideological house Negroes of the establishment during the 1960s and early 70s. Do you have any more reading to go through? Or is it finally over?
I mean, I think we could probably stop there, because I think we've made all the points that we really were looking to connect up together. I mean, I again, I'm just kind of interested to see how Prudentialists would square a lot of this understanding with how to then look at geopolitics, because I would sort of, again, in the way that Mises sort of looked at it, he's trying to separate geopolitical action from domestic political action and maintain it purely to economic organization, which doesn't seem to be the case. People are as much affected, if not more affected, by the fact that they are also part of the political apparatus as people who quote unquote rule themselves and vote, and that in doing so that you do create what is, despite all of the pretense towards rationality and pragmatism, a much more sort of spiritually charged and mythically charged sort of geopolitical situation. I mean, we are really getting what is a slightly contextualized war against good and evil, where the international community of human rights stands for all that's good and communism and fascism stands for all that's wrong.
Well, that's where you get the phrase, right, like a rules-based order, because if the international community is a rules-based order, we know that the international community is a rules-based order off of sort of that Anglo-American tradition.
And
go ahead.
And I was saying, the corollary of that is that anything that isn't part of the international community doesn't respect rules or order or us or our values, or, you know, much like the notion of the democratic consensus of peace or the democratic, I can't remember the term that he used anymore, but almost like a sort of doctrine.
It's like an international social contract almost.
Yeah.
That these people haven't signed the social contract, therefore we can't trust them and they must be destroyed.
We've got to go cut off all their hands so they can sign it.
Yeah, a super national social contract is pretty, that's pretty good. They might use that in the future. But no, I think what you're seeing, right, especially in like the modern context, with what, where economic, you know, entities will play a factor, but it's so much more than just the economic side of it all. In the United States, and what I think Bond has done a really good job at pointing out just within the literature that we went over today, is that there is a purposefully decentralized aspect for plausible, you know, deniability about things. Oh, it's a CIA, you know, operation. Okay, well, now we're going to move it to the Ford Foundation, or we're going to move it to the National Endowment for Democracy. It becomes a lot easier, I think, in 2022 to call out what they are, but there's reason for them when you can prop someone up domestically to get your goals accomplished. And on the global stage, right, you're seeing this model being used by other states as well, except for the Chinese. They're far more open about just being a state-operated enterprise. So you do have cultural groups there. You do have rejection of localization to ensure that you can get what you need and to assert your own sort of values-based identity or your own national identity. I do think that you've seen a radical change from the time of monarchy now to the modern time. I think that after World War One and what is inevitably a violent reaction to what was being imposed, that is the second, that this is where we really see what's happened. And I think that Bond outlines that perfectly. The politics of geopolitics is never a singular actor. I really do not like it when I hear other commentators, and I try myself to also really refrain from this, is when they say things like, oh, Washington, or oh, Moscow and Washington are in talks. It's never just Washington and Moscow. It's never just the foreign minister and the secretary of state talking, because you know damn well behind the scenes that there's going to be various aspects for pro-democracy organizations. You know that there's going to be intelligence apparatuses moving groups around. And the fact that there's like you mentioned with the Mujahideen, weapons being left behind. What do you think the same thing happened when we left a bunch of things open and available in Bagram Air Base? And oh, look at that! All of these foreign terrorists that have allegedly Muslim extremist ties coming in from Afghanistan into Kazakhstan when there's supposed to be an alleged color revolution. What are the odds? So, to me, the model that both Hoppe and what Bond really outlines is just, in my view, because I know this is sort of outlining what I would consider to be the obvious, but for anyone who needs a really good red pill, do understand that the international order right now, because the United States pursued a rather hubristically, in a matter of hubris, pursued this policy of primacy, overstretched itself in this idea of liberalization and democratic peace, you know, gave China the first world nation stat or first preferred nation status to the WTO. And it watched in 40 years itself be deindustrialized and watched the world go to a different trade partner over itself. And it's desperately trying to maintain that system that inevitably leads to its own demise while still maintaining control over the world order against a rising multipolar system of a very American skeptic European Union, a rising resurgent Russia, and a Chinese state that wishes to revise the world order towards a more economic middle kingdom.
There's a degree of almost self-sacrifice on the stage of globalism by America, though. I think that part of that is the internationalist plan. There's this idea, and they're not going to play ball with it. I know they're not going to play ball with it. And this, the concept that the Chinese are going to come into the fold and, you know, become one with this new world order is farcical. But the idea is literally China's going to be like the factory of the world. America's going to be the cultural center. Africa's going to be the, and South America are going to be the farm. And literally, I've heard economists say this. If you listen to even like mainstream British radio, sometimes you'll get people who come on and say incredibly mask off things like, oh, it's you know, in a globalized world, it's completely unfeasible to make cars in all these different countries. We should just make them all in China. and make China the car factory of the world. And they think in these extremely simplistic terms. It's very Blair. Yes, it's extremely Blair. Oh, yeah. Because they are like pure, uncut China white, like managerialists. And they can only see the world in this idea of, well, if we did this horrendous thing, it would make the world, by our metric, slightly more efficient. And I think a lot of these Western academics, especially the ones who aren't as Machiavellian inclined, they simply do not understand why China just won't roll over and become, you know, the factory of the world. It doesn't cross their minds that they might have a different agenda than making the spreadsheet work a bit better.
Mm.
And I think that's part of where this conflict comes in. That America, to a degree, has deliberately self-immolated because its elites are interested in internationalist power, and they do not, on some level, understand the depth of national feeling in places like Russia and China, because they simply do not feel it themselves.
And this is something that gets pointed out famously in Samuel P. Huntington's Clash of Civilizations in 1996, and he actually explicitly calls out American decline for this purpose. And that was, what now, 25 years ago, where he's talking about that, or 26 now, where he writes that because America, in its foreign policy, but also its cultural identity in this like neoliberalization for markets and international trade, has ceded so much of its like governmental authority to, you know, private entities, it makes itself explicitly vulnerable to the interests of international capital, and by extension, those who view the world in an international sense. So like, it sets itself up for self-immolation for this cultural and global governance, because moneyed interests and elites want that over the concept of the nation state, which is why you had all of those like really blunt articles where it was just sort of like academics saying like, huh, gee, why do these people like their country? Why are they voting for people like Trump or Brexit in 2016 over, you know, my free shit and my, you know, taco truck on every corner?
The problem is that like the political equivalent of Genghis Khan is going to sweep down from some unforeseen corner of the world and just murder all these people because they've become so weak and hollow. That's all I see, you know, maybe on the far horizon, but their politicking has become so finely balanced and the systems have become so fragile, and they do so much damage to themselves and their supposed allied nation states in the quest to knit them into this ever closer international community, that some actor who doesn't come from their world and play by their rules is going to blindside them at some point.
Well, that is why any of the institutions, or all of the institutions, depending on how they act in accordance with one another, must put the sort of pressure and stress of what they're trying to achieve on all of us by forcing us to work in shit jobs for the military-industrial complex, or watch horrendous war propaganda, or you're made to then subsequently feel guilty for voting for someone who took you into a war. You know, it's,
yeah.
It all becomes these very socio-psychological sort of phenomena, and it is very much past the point of being anything approaching rationality.
Yeah, don't worry about what you said earlier, Prudentialist. We don't mind going into like sociology aspects of it, because really, ultimately, geopolitics is all in people's minds.
Mm.
Like, if people were just left to be dirt farmers, they would have no concept of what was going on in the Ukraine.
Is that maybe the closing messages? It's all in your mind, man.
Well, it really is. People wouldn't know unless you told them what was going on in the Ukraine, because what is going on in the Ukraine does not actually affect them in a material sense.
Geopolitics not real. It doesn't real.
But to the extent that it's not real for, say, the farmer in Iowa, well, yes and no. And this is why I find that, especially today, especially in the 2020s, right, we put a lot of emphasis on, say, these models. We put a lot of emphasis on how governments work, or what's the preferred model. And the thing I like to say is that the world doesn't pause. Like, for instance, we're talking right now in an interconnected internet world wherein Russia is doing military exercises just outside of Ireland's exclusive economic zone that is conveniently over the tops of major international undersea cables for the internet. While at the same time, the Ukraine situation is literally trying to make sure that the leverage that the United States can put over Europe still exists because it doesn't want Germany to have a very close relationship with Russia. So why not make sure that a lot of Europeans face the highest energy prices that they've ever seen by trying to make sure that there's some sort of denial for Russian natural gas to come over to Europe, especially after the Ukrainians that had already an issue in 2009, already on the heels of the Orange Revolution, which the Americans were involved in, pretty much negotiated for higher transit fee prices, right? So they decide to not have any natural gas come over into Europe at that time, which makes the impetus for Nord Stream 2. All while at the same time with places like Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, Syria, energy plays a role here, information plays a role. I do agree with you entirely, though, that yeah, there's a lot of this where it is constructed. And I think that it kind of plays back to domestic governance, because you can't have one without the other.
Mm.
Oswald Spengler mentions in Decline of the West in Volume 2 explicitly that the nation state or the state of a country, the state of a people, the way in which they conduct themselves at home is the way in which they will conduct themselves abroad. And so when Burnham says that like liberalism is the ideology of suicide for the West, that's what we're witnessing on a global scale for anyone yes. that has a remotely Western Enlightenment tradition. Because inevitably you're setting yourself up for someone to conquer you. Like, this is why the American model is unsustainable in my perspective, and it needs to change in some different form of a regime. Because you can't say that you're anti-China and park your naval vessels right next to Taiwan in the South China Sea and form these relationships when you're not going to do a single thing in the name of national security, when you literally have Stanford University lobbying Congress saying, please don't investigate us for Chinese spying. Oh, by the way, we got caught with Chinese spying for like the last 10, 15 years. All of your Chinese elites come to American universities. We give more money to them than we would probably ever do, and they hold a lot of debt.
As I keep reminding people as well, America has black sites in China. Mm. They used to have them in Syria, but they decided that Syria was more profitable as a as a war-torn shithole. So it's that a lot of
there's reasons for that for pipelines that Semiagog and I reviewed over.
Oh, I know that, but it's the idea that Syria used to be our guy to an extreme degree, that we would ship people there so they would torture and kill them for us.
Let's not forget that Bashar al-Assad's a bloody ophthalmologist that lived in London for the best part of a decade. I mean, he is literally the best definition of our guy. I think, I don't know, we might have to possibly close it off there. I mean, I don't know, maybe...
I was going to close out by saying that in my second point was going to be the irony of geopolitics not being real is that it's not real until the power structure makes it real to make you do something, and that it will force you to care because it has to, in like a Kaczynskian sense of the world being so systematized that yes, it will affect you in some horrendous like Rube Goldberg of machine of human misery way. In the
wow,
because you are
was the bloody Peter Griffin one people keep sharing.
What was, I don't know.
Oh, I can't remember it now. Never mind.
Oh, the meme where Peter's on the chair and he's like, "Oh, sweet, man made horrors
beyond my comprehension."
Yeah, that's what it is. It's just like, no, if you refuse to care about the Ukrainian pipeline, they will make you care about it. They will make your life as the dirt farmer in Iowa as difficult as humanly possible until you care, because it is the only way that they can exercise their power. sorry, that was kind of the second part of my point there. It's just like, no, it isn't real, but you know they're in power, so they will make it real. But it is insane that all of you know the gas prices, the energy prices, people's everyday lives are deliberately interlinked with this insanity of politicking, and one feed, you know, it's a chicken. One does feed into the other, and the realities of ideology and the realities of power, you know, the ideology is often post hoc to really just what the elites want to happen, and they will explain it sometimes to completely different audiences in completely different ways. They will justify what's going on there. With geopolitics.
If you want a good reference to that, Scrump, I'm reminded of a speech that Tony Blair gave, I think, in Chicago in like 1996.
Yes.
And yeah, he had said explicitly that he wishes to move on from the Westphalian model. And then what do we, in terms of leading up to Iraq and Afghanistan, right? Like, what is it about? It's about nation building, the sovereignty of the nation to ensure that we rout out these terrorists and things like that, while at the same time making it more global and integrated and things like that. So it's this abolition in the name of the building of a state.
An abolition of Britain in many ways to... to bring it. I wish Hitchens was actually more based, but he's unfortunately a bit of a useless drunk at the moment. But yeah, you're right. We do need to run. It has been 2 hours, and I do need to go to bed relatively soon, since it's 11 p.m. and I have work in the morning. Thank you though for coming on, Prudentialist. We'll probably have you on again at some point. Although we do sometimes struggle to get these streams together because we're all quite busy people. There will be another article out hopefully next week on the Substack. I will finish something finally. Mm-hmm. I have like 3/4 of literally like 5 to 10 articles that I've done. So there's going to be a lot of stuff coming out at some point. But every time we get a new book, I realize I either need to read it or I need to get Evelyn to read it and give me the finer points before I can finish a lot of the stuff that I'm writing. Because it would be remiss of me not to include a lot of the great stuff that we've got.
Yeah, I don't think there will be a stream on Monday. I've got quite a few things to do next week. However, we can try and possibly string together a stream of some form for Thursday next week, I think.
Yes, even if it's just a more chill stream with you and me, Trig. I would like to do a slightly lighter stream at some point. A bit more of a fun one. Because these are good, but they are a little bit reading heavy. Although it is good to have a good mix of that stuff. I just wish we could do more.
I get a lot of requests for go back to doing your the infinite crab buckets type things.
Oh yeah, we need to have another infinite crab bucket crab and bucket. Yeah. I think it might just be good to do like a McWorld stream.
I would quite enjoy that, like, to be honest.
Okay, the title of next week's stream is McWorld the Infinite Strip Mall. How about that? And the thumbnail is just going to be an incredibly obese person falling off a rascaling Walmart.
Can we just have we need Bin Laden and Evola seething in the corner?
No, we need like Bin Laden laughing and Evola seething. Okay, we've already come up with next week's stream. But thank you for tuning in, guys. Thank you for everyone who still supports the channel, because in between actually last video and this stream, we've had like 4 or 5 people become members. Even though I've not got donations during this stream, we have had quite a bit of support in the intervening period. So thank you guys for your continuing support on that. And we will see you guys at some point next week. Is there anything any of you have to shill before we close out? It's almost forgot there.
As I said, this Sunday, same time for you guys, 9 p.m. GMT, I'll have quite a few guests on discussing the ongoing situation in Ukraine, because a lot more has developed in the last few days.
Sunday. the Prudentialist mega stream. Oh, no, it will. I'm going to go before this continues. Good night, everybody, and thank you for tuning in.
Good night.
Oh, there we go.